It's the network break. Brew a coffee and spin up a virtual donut and join us for this Packet Pushers podcast on the latest news from the tech industry with analysis, opinion, insight, and the occasional rant. I'm your host, Drew Connery Murray, and with me is the incomparable Greg Farrow. Greg, how are you?
I'm full of beer and victuals today. I've been making bread.
So you're all yeasty. You're all yeasty and ready to rise.
I am sugared up. I've been eating a load of carbos because I've been making my own focaccia, which is all olive oil and olives and deliciousness. And yes, full of vim and vigor today.
All right. So you're going to be really excited for 10 minutes and then carbo crash and fall asleep.
I got coffee to get me through the rest.
All right. Very good. Also joining us is our guest, Mike Fratto, Principal Analyst of Enterprise Networking and Data Center Technology at Current Analysis. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great, Drew. I'm doing fantastic.
All right. Always good to have you back. Before we dive into the news, I want to thank our sponsors today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from the data center to the cloud, so you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur. And we're also sponsored today by HPE and the Aruba Atmosphere Conference. Atmosphere is the leading wireless and mobility conference, and it's being held March 6th through 11th at the Cosmopolitan in Las Vegas. And we'll tell you a little bit more about it later. Okay, diving right into the news. Greg, you found a blog from Netflix about they have completed their full migration to the cloud.
Yeah, you would think from all the hyperbole and smoke and general smelliness that comes out of all the mouths of the people who are big public cloud boosters, namely analyst firms, that Netflix was a cloud company. As it turns out, that Netflix wasn't a cloud company and only just released a blog post saying that they are now all in for the cloud. Good for them, hey? It took them 7 years.
Right, 7 years.
To go all in with the cloud. So just think about that. Your Netflix, everything that you do is in the cloud. At every AWS conference, you stand up and you're held up as a poster child for what you can do in the cloud. And it took you 7 years to move all your legacy apps. And I mean, you've got the best people. You've got all the experiences of knowing how to run AWS and to use its proprietary APIs and use all of its proprietary third portals. And you've written software that goes on top. You've open sourced software. You've got so much software. You're giving it away because, you know, other people might as well use it because then you might get some, you know, you've recruited the best people in the world to run your cloud platform. And it still took them 7 years to get all in on the cloud.
Yeah, and part of that, they call this out in the blog, is that it took 7 years because they didn't just, you know, take what they had in the data center, package it up in a VM, and pop it onto an instance in the cloud. They actually went back and re-architected all their system using microservices to be cloud native. And the quote from the blog is that we did this because we didn't want all the problems and limitations of the data center to just follow them along into the cloud. So I think that's a fair point.
It's the key point, and it's one of the things that other analyst firms, not mine or me, but in seriousness, I mean, a lot of people commenting about the cloud and the public cloud proponents and the fanboys and all of that, they kept saying, just move to the cloud, move to the cloud, move to the cloud. And when you talk to them, you know, for the most part, their answer was, take what you have now, package it up into a VM and push it into AWS, and you're done. You've got high availability, and you've got bandwidth, and you can scale up, and you can scale down, and you can scale. And you know, they talk about all these things you can do, but I'm not an application guy. But I know, for example, that a lot of applications, and they made the point in the, you know, the guys from Netflix made the point in the blog, a lot of applications are monolithic. And so it's not like, and what I mean by that is you can't just simply scale one component up. You know, the application has to be architected that way. So if you need more, if you need faster access to your database, you can't just add another database or expand it and make it better. You've got to do more stuff to it.
Yeah, if you've been using Microsoft SQL Server, there's only one way to expand Microsoft SQL Server.
Yeah.
Pick up your whole database and move it onto another Microsoft SQL Server, or make your Microsoft SQL Server physically larger, more memory, more CPUs, bigger, you know, more modern Intel CPUs. You don't have a choice. Right, and if you spent 15 years writing your code to pull on Microsoft SQL, and you've been using Microsoft's proprietary stored RPC functions to store that data, guess what you're in for? A very bad 5 years of writing that code and the cost. Yeah,
right. And I mean, it's the application that's going to drive that move to cloud. And again, this is something that comes out of this Netflix blog, and so it's going to it'll take 10 to 15 years, and I know everybody's going to say, oh, no, Fratto's wrong. It's not going to take that long. It'll take 10 to 15 years before the application space really starts to catch up and you start seeing applications that are going to be, you know, cloud ready. And to be honest with you, I don't think infrastructure as a service, that's a stepping stone. I think if you're in the business right now of moving to if you're a company that wants to move into a cloud strategy, forget infrastructure as a service. Go right to platform as a service. Mm. Skip all of that messy middle and just architect your apps for the next 30 years.
The way I see it, this is a reason as to why private cloud is going to succeed and be far larger than public cloud, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because you have these legacy apps. You can take those legacy apps and move them onto a cloud infrastructure and still use them. And then they're pseudo cloud. They're not real cloud and they're not whatever. But you haven't. And then you can start your 20-year migration strategy of replacing your core banking app or your core warehousing app or your Microsoft SQL service and moving it onto, you know, React, MongoDB, blah, blah, blah. But you don't have to deal with the people in the cloud going, oh, but our data centers aren't redundant. They're not critical. We don't do HA between data centers. That's up to you. You know, all that stuff that they just keep telling you can't do, you just ignore it. So it's 7 years for a full-on technology company that does nothing but technology, who can hire and afford to hire the best people in the world and know the AWS platform intimately. How the hell is any normal enterprise IT company that barely has enough headcount to count how many computers they own going to be able to match that capability?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I do want to point out one thing. Netflix is sort of this shining example of being relatively transparent about what they're doing, both their successes and their challenges. And I mean, there's a lot to learn there that any other company, whether they're a cloud first, cloud native company or a service company like Netflix or a manufacturing company, there are lessons to learn from what Netflix has talked about over the years.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think one of the lessons that you can take back home is not, even if you're building private rather than public cloud, is what Netflix really focused on was the fact that they were building, and they called it unreliable but redundant components. So they knew pieces of the application were going to fail. That's just how it works. And so they planned for that in the way they architected the whole infrastructure, so that the failure of one component doesn't crash the whole system, that other components will be able to spin up and recover and so on. Mm. And that kind of architectural idea doesn't have to just sit in the public cloud. You can also bring that back to the way you develop applications on premises.
So this leads into the discussion. Verizon this week announced that they're closing down two of their public cloud services. Now, lots of people say, oh, but everybody's a failure. Only Amazon and Azure can do public cloud, blah, blah, blah. But do you wonder if it's because nobody's actually spending money on the public cloud or nobody's spending enough? Did we all rush into the public cloud thinking that trillions of dollars would be spent on the public cloud, and then slowly people are realizing that actually it's decades before significant use of the public cloud? And when I say significant, I mean, AWS is a $10 billion a year business, not an insignificant amount of money, but out of the nearly $1 trillion we spend in computing in the world today, it's an insignificant drop. Right. And so are we seeing these public cloud services shutting down, HP, Verizon, because now's not the time to be doing public cloud? It's just too early. It's a startup business, effectively.
Yeah, we are. The predictions about the market for public cloud were way overinflated, and a lot of these organizations were listening. Unfortunately, they're listening too much. And there was, I was talking to somebody, I think 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And he had made the point that there are these carriers, and he didn't name any names, but it was a large multinationals. They have these huge, vast data centers which are basically powered up, and they're waiting for the market to show up, kind of like the networking glut from the 2000s, where there was millions of miles of cable that just weren't being used, waiting for demand to show up.
Yeah, overcapacity. Overspending. There's entire we're getting to the point where owning data centers has become an exercise in financial triage. There are companies listed like Digital Realty, for example, who specialize in buying data centers on a 20 to 40 year time cycle and then treat them like a long-term asset ownership cycle, like in the same way as they would with gas works and electricity companies. You don't buy them to expect 50% growth in a single year. You buy them because they produce a nice, comfortable, flatline 5% return year on year. And it's a nice and it's for people who've got big money. You have to have $5 billion to enter the business,
So I'm curious whether I take your point about market size and maybe overestimating just how much of an appetite there was, but I also wonder, are the carriers just not that good at selling infrastructure as a service or sort of your basic, entry-level public cloud opportunity? because my impression is what they want to do is, you know, upsell you, get you into the managed services platform. They want to lard on a bunch of other options, and maybe they just aren't sort of, you know, designed internally in the way they run their business to go after that sort of dirt cheap, really low cost, really easy to provision from a portal. They don't have to talk to anybody, spin up like AWS model. Are they just not good at it?
I think AWS, ultimately, there was no demand for public cloud before it existed. AWS built it for itself and then realized it could sell it. So there is a need for it. At this point in time, I see public cloud, as I've always said, is for poor people. If you haven't got any capital because your business model is basically, is so weak that you can't raise enough money to buy assets and spend time building it up, or if you're in a dying market and the risk of investing capital to build a data center is so high, sure, the cloud's really attractive as a financial model. And then once you make the financial decision, then moving to the cloud is fairly straightforward. We saw, for example, Zynga, when it became really, really big, the first thing it did was move out of AWS into its own data centers, moved all of it, a lot of services, because it could save a lot of money at scale. And then Zynga got smaller, and there was an article this week or last week that Zynga moved everything back into the cloud. You know, fine, good. Zynga's business model is cash flow, and if there's no cash, there's no capital either. So that's what they do to survive. Yay them. Yeah. I don't see the public cloud as, you know, the coming of a white knight. Sure, AWS has done a good job of building a public cloud. But the thing that I also see is that we still haven't seen what I call extinction events or nuclear events. So if public cloud is going to be huge and is going to dominate the supply for the industry, then it looks exactly like nuclear electricity in the 1960s. In the 1960s, everybody said nuclear power is going to save us. It's going to replace coal. Electricity will be cheap. It would be so cheap that you can't even be bothered to meter it. And then we had, you know, the critical events with the nuclear power where entire power stations were lost and radiation leaks and things like that. Public cloud hasn't been around long enough to have those critical events, to see if the failure of a substantial amount of computing infrastructure results in some net damage to society that results in government legislation. So if you were to lose the US East, let's say some part of the US East data center caught on fire and burned down, something like 40% of all US companies would stop working immediately. And for the bulk of those would never recover because they're all in on that one. You know, they're only inside that data center and they're all, and the data is not stored out, or the data might be stored outside of the data center, but you're talking about weeks to recover from that. We haven't seen those events yet to decide, you know, on a risk profile basis, whether we can survive. I suspect we're going to end up much more like a model like the electricity industry, where the nuclear power consumption is 25% or 40% of your total baseload generation. And then you have coal-fired power stations producing 30 or 40% of your base load. And then you have a bunch of gas-powered turbines. And gas-powered turbines are just, you know, all over the country to provide peak load for the 2 hours in the evening when everybody comes home from work. I think that's much more likely the way the cloud's going to go. There'll be this variety of choice from where we put our compute, and it will vary according to what you're going to achieve, what sort of power you need.
Yeah, I mean, well, part of the problem of the discussion is that we talk about it like it has to be a binary decision, either or, and that's obviously not the case. That's not how technology works. There's going to be a mix of opportunities and different ways of doing it, including some mix of public, private, and hybrids. Just the way it's going to go.
Yeah, with Zynga, they didn't when Zynga moved their applications out of AWS. They didn't move all of them. They moved their games, their gaming systems, the things that had to happen in near real time, and they needed control over the performance and the ability to scale up and scale down. What they kept in AWS was all of the stuff that didn't need to be, you know, real time. If latency or delay was, you know, 500 milliseconds, you know, for a transaction to process, going from the client, process at the service, and then back, things like, you know, updating scores and IAM and that kind of stuff, those things they could put into AWS, and that worked fine, and they got to leverage the CDN, they got to leverage the distribution of AWS globally. So, I mean, they made intelligent decisions about, you know, the things that were really critical that we needed control over, we're going to pull those back. The stuff that, you know, I mean, that highlights that there's multiple uses for the cloud, like Greg is saying. Mm. You're going to use some aspect of cloud and private depending on whatever your needs are. And, you know, those should be relatively seamlessly transferable when you need to.
Yeah. So I think we've rung out the public cloud discussion, so let's move on here.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, if you've got more to say, Greg, you can write a blog about it.
It's so much easier just to say it, you know, really.
Yes, right. It takes less time. Yeah. Greg, you found a story from Network World about Wi-Fi feeling some pressure in the IoT space from other wireless protocols in that, you know, Wi-Fi has a built-in platform, but it's also it eats a lot of power. And so there's some new developments up front on the Wi-Fi frontier about making Wi-Fi more suitable for IoT. And one of those is 802.11ah.
Yeah, so this is kind of like an FU from a couple of weeks ago. That's a follow-up.
Not the other FU.
Where I said, I think, I mean, I was reading about 802.11ah and talk about how the use of the 8 to 900 megahertz band allowed for a whole different use case, and this was going to be, could be used for mobile backhaul. This article talks about actually the use of Wi-Fi as an IoT standard. So if it gets opened up, then chipsets that could use narrower channels in this range could dramatically reduce chip power requirements, and you could start to talk about a very penetrating Wi-Fi signal. So they're talking here 40-plus meters range at 150 kilobits, which is just enough for your Fitbit, Apple Watch, sensors on doors, sensors on windows, temperature sensors, air conditioning sensors, power, you know, in your electricity box, all those types of things to form little low-powered, low-speed networks, just enough to say door open, door closed. They don't need, you know, gigabit Ethernet to run those. And this is how IoT is going to change the shape of networking in the future. So I pointed out this article. It's in the show notes. If you want to understand a little bit more about what 802.11ah could stand for, that's what it is, and it's not what I said last time. I got it wrong.
Okay, we're going to mark that in the notes.
You what now?
I've always said I just make stuff up. I'm not always right. No, I got this one wrong. I thought it was going to be used for mobile backhaul. Now, it's possible that there are multiple competing standards for use in this spectrum, right? So if it's an open spectrum, there might be multiple competing standards, but I haven't spent enough time researching it to know it for sure.
So I have a little bit.
Excellent. That's why we get you along.
Yeah, I was actually looking for my notes. There's I've counted 19 plus wireless protocols using various radio technologies and various L2, L3 technologies. There's quite a few of them. 802.15.4, you know, the WPAN. I mean, I think that can go up to like 100 meters. Bluetooth can actually go up to 100 meters, by the way. You typically don't use it. It's the power requirements are there.
Yes.
Aren't there. There's a ton of different RF spectrum that's being used, and the problem is there are so many different competing standards, and all of these, you know, in order to use them, obviously they need to be implanted in hardware. And so you're looking at like industrial IoT, they've settled on a number of protocols like Wireless HART and others, which Cisco and one of their ruggedized wireless routers, they actually have I'm forgetting the protocol. I think it might be Wireless HART or something like that, actually in the AP itself. But you can only use that. So it's only going to be used for those sensors and controllers that use that protocol. So adding another protocol like AH, you know, maybe interesting, but it's just one more out of, you know, 20 or 23, and that doesn't even include all the proprietary protocols that are out there. Mm-hmm. So it's this whole IoT space is going to be in the commercial sector really needs to consolidate.
And it's going to be confusing because we need what I feel confident about is that the current generation of Wi-Fi technology isn't ready or suitable for the internet as such, like the IoT. There's just not the right density or not the right use cases around that.
All right, before we go on with the show, I just want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, ThousandEyes. So as your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. And that's a problem when you're running critical apps, websites, and services. What ThousandEyes does is gives you visibility into every network that your company relies on. So that's your corporate network, the internet, your service provider, all from one place. They've got cloud agents that are deployed in locations all across the globe and enterprise agents that provide visibility from within your own network. And so together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of your topology, dependencies, and behavior. And so with Thousand Eyes, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, whether it's BGP routing, DNS, or web server and layer 3 performance. You can precisely pinpoint root causes of problems, like a device fault or congestion, DDoS attacks, and more. You can also share the data and insights that you've got with vendors and customers so that you can resolve problems faster. And Thousand Eyes has a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free Thousand Eyes t-shirt. So start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. Thousand Eyes is network intelligence you can see. And thanks to Thousand Eyes. Greg, you found another provider or vendor blog. This is from LinkedIn talking about its white box network strategy.
Yeah, this is the rise of white box hasn't finished yet. So a lot of people are saying that the big vendors have started to get the control back over customers and to prevent the rise of white box. But what we now have is the second tier of web scalers, in my opinion. So in this case, it's LinkedIn talking about how they're using white box to change the profile of costing and the way the network works for them, which I think is interesting. In this case, LinkedIn's pretty blunt, and they just said, we have not been able to find a vendor product that is reliable enough for use in our data centers. The vendor products wasn't able to give us the visibility or the monitoring or just plain unreliable, so we went and built our own. And that's, I think, a bit damning of our existing networking vendors to say that. And we've seen that before. So we've seen Facebook say the same thing, Google say the same thing. Amazon's done the same thing and said, you know, we're just not happy with the existing products that we're receiving, so we went out and built our own. And to see LinkedIn, even sort of like 2 years after we've seen the other companies do it, says that it's still a problem today.
Yeah. So you talked about earlier about Netflix and how they have the engineering capability on site to do re-architecting of all their applications to be cloud native. Is an organization that's going white box need that same kind of in-house chops to really take advantage of white box? Like, is that going to be the limiter that if you're an Uber scale, like a LinkedIn or an Amazon or Google, maybe white box is for you, but what about if you don't have the internal engineering resources to build your own?
It's a budget thing, right? You've got two choices. You can pay AWS to do that, and then you're also paying AWS a very generous profit margin to run that infrastructure for you. Or you could hire your own people and then build that infrastructure yourself. So in the case of LinkedIn, they're full of smart people who work there. And they figured that it's cheaper for them to build their own networking device than it is for them to keep buying vendor stuff or, you know, move their entire IT infrastructure into the cloud.
Right. But that's, so my question is white box then just a corner case for the big organizations that do have the internal resources to adopt a white box strategy, which means building a whole bunch of management and monitoring capabilities around it, not just buying the switches and racking them?
I think that's true today. And the thing that I've learned from being in networking over the years is that that will change over time. So as big companies like Facebook and LinkedIn work it out, then you'll see startups taking that technology and turning it into products. So in a sense, Big Switch, for example, which was 2 or 3 years ago when they introduced an open source Linux, and then Facebook a year later introduced an open source, they started building open source applications for white boxes. And we've seen, you know, Spotify do something similar. We've seen LinkedIn do something similar. I think the point here is that with sufficient commitment, it's really easy just to go and get an open source operating system and build your own instead of going and buying it from a vendor. And again, not that everybody who's listening here is suddenly going to race out and cut their own operating system for their network switches. It's a choice customers can now make. They're not locked into only buying from the commercial vendors. You can now have a choice to go and make this decision. Whether that decision's right for you is not something that this podcast can help you with.
One of the things I think is happening in the market, and it was, you know, pretty clear from that LinkedIn blog, you know, they had a particular need. They needed to get, you know, low level telemetry out of the chipset, which was there. And, you know, Broadcom has it. They have, you know, their open NSL library, which can give access. They have their Broadview, which has to be licensed to give, you know, to give access. So they had a very particular need. So it's always that capability has been in the chips that are sitting in enterprises networks right now. It's just,
well,
it's
not enabled. No, there's not that much merchant silicon in enterprise networks. It's still all proprietary. The vast majority of enterprise IT is still sitting on their Cisco or HP ProCurves or their, you know, whatever it is, but that's all custom silicon. Nobody's thrown out their switches yet.
Nobody's throwing out their switches, but like, Arista Extreme. I mean, there's a bunch of others out there that are running merchant silicon. And so my point being, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of proprietary silicon out in the world. It's pretty clear that most networking companies now are moving towards a merchant silicon base, mm-hmm. with a couple of holdouts, you know, Cisco and HP being two of them. But my point is they had this particular need for this telemetry. It had been available in the merchant silicon. It just had never been exposed. Mm-hmm. And so what I think is going to happen is I don't think enterprises are going to go out. A typical enterprise is going to go out and roll their own OS. I don't even think they're going to go out and buy a white box switch and buy another OS unless there's support and professional services and all of that stuff that they get now from a current vendor. But what I think we will see productized is more companies using merchant silicon, exposing some of this information. I know, for example, some of the newer switches from ALE, they've integrated Broadview, you know, the Broadcom's Broadview, which does burble up a lot of this sort of low-level information, at least into their analytics package. So by exposing this, and I think we're going to start seeing more exposure from networking vendors, in particular, you know, Dell with their recent disaggregated OS. They didn't get into these details, but it wouldn't be a big leap for them to open up some of those capabilities. And the nice thing is if you're an enterprise and you're buying a product that exposes this, you don't have to go to Broadcom and buy that license for Broadview. So there's some potential there that I think we're going to see in the next couple of years. Mm. To open up some of these capabilities.
There's two wins here. One is some enterprises might choose to go and do this themselves. I'm thinking of very large banks or companies who have a certain type of technology bent or focus, and they could go and do this. But the wider market is going to win if this emphasis on telemetry gets out into the wild. So that is, I watched a Tech Field Day presentation recently on OpenConfig, which is an initiative being led by Google about providing access to telemetry data from switches. Now, telemetry is kind of like taking SNMP and throwing it in the bin and saying, that is a load of junk. Let's start from the ground up and get the information out of the switch that we really want. It needs to be dynamically defined. It needs to be dynamically specified so the data set can't be fixed. We should be able to write our own data formats. It should be using REST and JSON formats. It should be, you know, all modern and fancy-dancy, mm-hmm. you know. We'll get it right this time around for a while until we realize our mistakes, and then we'll do it again in 2 years' time. But, you know, that's the idea. And the point is it's the telemetry factor that is now – if LinkedIn and, you know, all of those big – what I call the FANG companies, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, FANG. If FANG – it's like an evil consortium of death to capitalists. You know, if the FANG companies can go out there and – say basically we're building switches and one of the key features for us is telemetry, it seems reasonable that capitalism will drive our existing vendors to go and put telemetry into their switches if their silicon can do it. And this is where the end of custom silicon is easily predicted, because the current generation of silicon that companies like Cisco and HP and Juniper are pushing out the door don't have the telemetry capabilities because they wouldn't have designed it in.
I think Cisco with their N9000s and ACI, I think they built in some of those capabilities. We're starting to see a little bit here and there, but I think the merchant silicon for everybody else, that's where it's going to drive it. And if the networking equipment vendors are paying attention to what that LinkedIn blog is really saying, which is we don't want to build our own OS, but we had to because you weren't giving us what we needed. Mm-hmm. If they're paying attention, they'll start doing that.
Yeah. But yeah. Don't – the other thing too is I've spoken to some people at LinkedIn about it, and they also said, yeah, you also realize that, you know, it was $100,000 to buy a vendor switch to do this, and we built our own at a nominal cost of $5,000.
Sure.
Mm. So the cost of the headcount to write the code and to do the testing and the blah, 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 because, of course, they're buying, you know, 500 or 1,000 of these things.
Yeah.
This is what I mean, you know, like you can save a lot of money by doing this and get a better solution. So it's the financial aspect of it is really simple, the use case. Yeah.
Maybe that's the future of SCN, writing your own operating system.
So if you subscribe to the Human Infrastructure magazine, if you go to packetpushers.net/human-infrastructure and subscribe to our magazine, you'll see some links in there this week where I linked to Spotify, who were writing their own software for a white box switch to replace their internet routers. Mm. So head on over there and sign up for that magazine if you haven't already.
All right. Moving on, Greg, you identified a story from Fortune about VMware pinning some of its hopes on NSX for growth.
Yeah, the latest financial results for VMware were announced this week, and then it promptly got, the share price got promptly trounced because, like every other technology company in the U.S. today, they're all predicting that enterprise spending is winding back by 5%, so they're all predicting shrinking quarters ahead. And that's right across the board. So firewall companies, Palo Alto Networks is down 10%. Some LinkedIn fell 50% last week, of course, and that's happening right the way across the technology spectrum. The only company not to do to suffer at the moment is Cisco. Talk more about that later on. So everybody's looking at VMware, which is, of course, a linchpin in the EMC Dell tie-up, of course. And the basic assumption is that now that's virtualization sales, so that's ESX, vCenter, vSphere, is slowing down, so that market is effectively saturated. More importantly, they can't continue to increase the price of that product because there's cheaper alternatives out there. So OpenStack, KVM, Microsoft with its Azure Private Cloud. So VMware's got a maximum price that it can't just keep jacking it up and screwing over people who've locked themselves into that ecosystem because they might start turning away. So growth has to come from somewhere. That really leaves just two divisions in the VMware unit. One is the end user compute, or you might call it virtual desktop VDI, which is never going to grow because nobody cares about VDI except a very small number of people, and the NSX. So NSX, of course, is the big hope for growth, and not unreasonably so.
Why do you think it's reasonable to expect big growth from NSX? I mean, there'll be growth, but replacement growth for licensing?
Yes. Well, first of all, there's no hardware, it's just software. So everything's basically raw profit margin. That's how come they can afford to hire hundreds and hundreds of sales reps just selling NSX. You know, every sales rep theoretically can cover their costs because there's no manufacturing cost behind NSX. The second thing is, so you can scale it straight up, right? Unlike ACI, you've got to hold assets, and you've got to hold switches and stock and all that sort of stuff. The second thing about NSX is I was working with a client this week setting out their OpenStack strategy, and we were talking about what sort of networking do we want and how does it look. And when you start to consider that they've got a substantial amount of VMware in their network and they have some legacy, they've built a cloud orchestration engine around an ES orchestration engine for their vCloud 5.1. They're going to go into OpenStack, and then over here we've got containers coming up. We're not sure which container we're going to be, but it's sort of like in the 3 to 5 year horizon, we know that containers are going to be coming. But we've also got 9 other business units that all need to have their networks connected together in some way, and we need an overlay networking capability that's going to be able to talk to each other. When you start thinking about that type of business model, who do you actually start to buy? Do you start to talk to PlumGrid or Mitakura? Do you start to look at Cisco with its virtual switching initiative? So you say that ACI is going to orchestrate all those together and then, you know, but pay the penalty of, say, VMware's and Cisco's pricing model? Or do you start to look at some of the roll-your-own Linux overlay solutions like Calico or, you know, these others? NSX is a very viable product in that market. It's software only. You don't need to change anything that you're doing today. You can put it in incrementally. You don't have to do, like, really to make ACI viable in your network, you have to throw out most of your network in your data center and start again. And that's not always easy for people to do. So I think NSX can expect some growth. Not an infinite amount of growth, but some.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine it would have the same kind of growth that ESX or the hypervisor market did. They can get some growth out of it, but I don't think we're going to see a duplicate of that, of ESX.
No, VMware is going to have to really put a lot of focus in making NSX a viable, not only a viable but an attractive alternative to whatever you have in Neutron for OpenStack and other hypervisor and you know private cloud technologies. They're moving down that path, but it's taking them a very long time, I think, in you know internet years to sort of get there and show direction.
Well, customers are holding the vendors back to some extent by saying, ooh, we don't want to go too far. We don't want too much. Hmm. And the second part is that I still have the view that enterprise IT operates like a luxury marketplace in the same way that they don't want low-cost alternatives. They don't want to buy cheap. They want to pay the maximum amount of money for something to get imaginary features or imaginary quality or perceived value rather than real value. And they can't discriminate between the two. And this is where ACI and NSX, you know, they have the luxury brand. They are the Hermes or the Louis Vuitton of the IT networking marketplace, and they can expect growth because they're the luxury brand in those markets.
And they've got the network bling.
They have the network bling, but you know, for the most part, it also, I mean, they're also delivering, you know, both Cisco and VMware are delivering on their promises, and other SDN vendors as well. I mean, the value is you get versatility, it's, you know, easier to manage, and hopefully you get, you know, better visibility and better telemetry. You know, there's a host of things that are sort of coming along as well. Whether or not today those benefits are enough to take the plunge with a particular technology, I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of that's a situational decision.
Hmm. I just think, you know, Cisco can go and leverage its existing customers who's, you know, Cisco owns the lion's share of the data center networks and just say, you should be buying ACI. And NSX can go and leverage its position in the VMware market and saying, you should be doing NSX. And increasingly, you know, just to show you how much waste an enterprise IT team can make, companies are deploying both NSX and ACI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Money is not a concern in enterprise IT. For all the lip service they make of it, clearly that's not true.
Well, it's what typically networking is typically a 10% of a project spend if you were to cost that on a per project basis. So it's not a huge part of the IT budget or even a project budget.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that in enterprise IT, they'll get rid of two headcount and then go and spend, you know, two headcount to save $250,000 a year and then spend $5 million on overpriced technology. Instead of choosing to buy 1 million of technology and keep the headcount, that's the reality.
Unfortunately, I think you're right. Let's leave that there for now. And I found this story. This is looking a little bit more toward the future. Google's self-driving car AI can now qualify as a driver, according to U.S. regulators. This is a story coming out of VentureBeat. So I guess the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration sent Google a letter saying, yes, this AI that you've proposed for driverless cars can be considered a driver under federal law. This allows Google to start moving forward with a little bit more experimentation. Although there are still hurdles, doesn't mean we're going to start having autonomous cars out on the road yet. Google has to demonstrate it can meet some certifications, that it will meet federal safety requirements and so on. There's a lot of work to do. But this seems to me sort of like a significant point going forward in driving this technology.
Better than a Turing test.
A turning test instead of a Turing test.
So Turing test.
So who's Turing. Mike? If Google's self-driving car, if it's AI, can qualify as a driver, does that mean Google's paying the insurance bill?
I think that is a fantastic question. That is absolutely a fantastic question.
Immediately, the biggest thing around self-driving cars is the liability.
Who pays the insurance?
Who pays the insurance? If there's now you can argue until you're blue in the face that they're safer and they're going to be more reliable and there'll be less accidents and less death. But it's at this particular point, it's only going to, you know, someone's got to pay the insurance bill, and the person who's in the car that isn't driving isn't going to be culpable, under my understanding of the law, unless there's some, you know, legal gymnastics going on. But if the AI is a driver, then Google theoretically is on the hook for the insurance.
And I actually can see Google stepping up to be on the hook for insurance, because part of this isn't just, hey, we've got a self-driving car and it's cool. They're going to also be able, I think, try to maximize the value of having a captive driver in there who is going to consume other internet services, who's going to generate data, who's going to be able to be sold to and marketed to, you know, while the car is tootling along. So for the insurance, you know, is going to be maybe an initial cost up front, but over time, as AI proves out, it's not really going to be that much.
Well, here's a quote from the letter that they submitted. Google expresses concern that providing human occupants of the vehicle with mechanisms to control things like steering, acceleration, and braking could be detrimental to safety because human occupants could attempt to override the self-driving system's decisions.
Yeah, which means Google doesn't want, you know, messy humans fooling around with their clever AI.
Oh, and then damaging their brand when the car crashes because the human interfered with it.
Exactly.
Because people aren't going to blame the human. They're going to blame the computer, right?
Right. Well, so that's why if Google sells you a car that's driven by their AI, it's not going to have a steering wheel. It's not going to have brakes. It's going to have a push button that you start, and then you just sit there, and the car does
it. I want to have a sofa with a cocktail bar right next to it.
That's right.
And over here is – I don't want a bucket seat, right? I don't want a bucket seat in my self-driving car. I want a sofa with a seatbelt, and it's got to be able to – and preferably there should be a little foot thing underneath so I can lean back and just enjoy the –
Heck yeah.
None of this bucket seat rubbish. driving experience of the open road, the magic of that feeling of the wind in your hair. Well, speaking of wind in your hair, today's show is sponsored by HPE/Aruba and the Atmosphere Conference in Las Vegas in March 6th to the 11th. Now, Packet Pushers is going to be there. Ethan and I are both flying in to record a bunch of podcasts. And what we want to tell you about is, A, if you're going to Aruba Atmosphere, make sure you look out and follow us at Packet Pushers, because we'll be holding some tweet-ups, meet-ups, and you could meet us if that's of interest to you. We'll also be recording a bunch of podcasts on the Aruba announcements that are going on there. Aruba's got a bunch of things to announce at that conference. There's some pretty big news. I've had some sneak peeks, and I'm a little thrill, a little frisson of excitement that something new is coming to the industry. So maybe if you're thinking about going to Aruba Atmosphere, then you should pop along, because actually I haven't seen this conference before, and it's always fun to go to a new conference. Aruba Atmosphere, they're going to be talking about all sorts of interesting things. There's a whole complete training regime. I was a bit surprised to see that the conference runs for 6 days. There's really 2 days of where the real conference is, but the rest of it is training, and that's all part of your entrance fee. Give it a look. So if you go to arubanetworks.com/atmosphere, you'll be able to get all the details on the conference, and then look out for the podcast, which we'll be publishing starting in mid-March.
All right, keep an eye out for that. Greg, another story that you pulled out, yet another open source foundation for our cheat sheet, FD.io. What is that all about?
Well, first of all, it's yet another open source foundation, at least one a week. Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
I think we've missed a few because I got bored talking about them.
They're breeding like rabbits.
Yeah, yeah. This one, it looks like Cisco's dropped a hand grenade in the virtual switching market. I'm going to go off half-cocked here. I haven't spent all my time reading up about it. But the FDIO is a open source foundation designed to promote the VPP technology that Cisco has developed. It's got a bunch of its buddies around, and they've all had a cup of coffee and maybe even some beers, formed a foundation and congratulated each other with how clever they are about banding together to be a team. It's very exciting. It looks like it's just the data plane only. The big thing about the data plane is that the way that packets forward up off the NIC and then through the operating system and then back out the NIC, or whether they flow up to the app, mostly that's done by kernel modules, so normally BPF in the Linux code, or if you're OVS, OVS can be installed as a kernel module. There's been a rising groundswell of "we hate OVS" from people. They say that OVS is not really the way forward. There's a number of so-called experts. I wouldn't regard them as experts, but they claim to be, and they're sort of saying that OVS isn't the sort of thing that they want. And so VPP seems to be a step in a direction to give you yet another way. This does leave you open for control planes. So if you are PlumGrid or Project Calico or one of the 35 other startups or open source projects that write programs, the forwarding table in these virtual switches using BGP or Flow or, you know, some other arcane method, OSPF, whatever you like, you'll be pleased to know that you now have another choice of a data plane in the Linux kernel. And its biggest claim to fame is that it sits in user space, not in the Linux kernel. That means that you don't need to go and wait 3 years for it to be approved as a viable part of the Linux kernel. And the people who made the code will be sighing a sigh of relief because they don't have to get it through past Linus, who is pretty notorious for scanning all the code that goes into the kernel very, very closely. And it's a fair bet that this code is rubbish. And until it's proven out, otherwise I'm going to stick with that line.
Okay, half-cocked right there. Woo.
Well, if it comes from a vendor, they're usually their first attempts at code are pretty ordinary.
I read over the site very quickly. Do you have any insight into what VPP is and why we should even care?
It's a data plane. So it's the forwarding engine that comes out of Cisco's vSwitches, the AVX1000, the ACI, all of the stuff that they've been using. And it's just the code that pulls the packet off the NIC and drives it to the app. And instead of it being in the kernel module like you do today, like the NIC driver's in the kernel or whatever, VPP does everything in user space. That's it.
Yeah. Looks like we're going to there's more to it. I have to do some investigation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're talking about, rather than pipelining the code through, you know, or a packet through the pipeline, it seems like it's more, we're going to do a whole bunch of similar operations and then move a wad of packets to the next stage in the queue, and then we're going to do a bunch of stuff to it, and then we're going to move it to the next stage in the queue. You know, it's like this operating on
yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just curious.
Cisco's vSwitch hasn't had a sterling reputation, right? Mm-hmm. People who've used it on the NX 1000, I've seen as far more negative than I've seen positive about it. I've seen people talking about ACI implementations in containers sort of equal numbers of good and bad experiences around it. The fact that Cisco sort of open sourced this is a good move. It's a contributor. It's also leadership. Cisco's got a position to draw the market around something. There is a significant amount of anti-OVS, anti-open vSwitch sentiment. This looks like a coagulation of that. I haven't got any view into whether it's well-founded, whether this product is viable, whether it's got some magic associated with it. You know, there are what we now have is three data planes. And I, remember, I'm going off half-cocked here because I haven't had enough chance to read all the stuff. So, you know, I could be wrong and come back next week with an FU, right? But it looks as if Cisco's had this code. It's decided to open source it. It's got a bunch of its buddies around. It's a third way of doing the data plane in the Linux operating system. The three of them are open vSwitch, BPF, Berkeley Packet Filters, which has been part of Linux for 30 years. iovisor.org is the champion of this. And now there's VPP, which is part of FDIO, right? If you run control, the real value isn't in the data plane here. It's like switches are these days. Who cares how the packet comes off the NIC and up to the operating system as long as it happens at the fastest possible time and the lowest possible latency? The real value isn't in this project. The value is in how do you program the forwarding tables in that software vSwitch. So if you're OpenContrail, if you're PlumGrid, if you're Project Calico, if you're NSX, if you're ACI, they're going to maybe use VPP as the engine, but the question is how do you program the forwarding tables? And the answer, whether you're using VPP or BPF or OVS, now you're arguing over whether a six-cylinder inline is better than a V6. Mm-hmm. And if you're only driving to the corner shop to buy a sausage roll, who cares?
Right.
So, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. There's an article here on light reading. They talk about, they did an evaluation of it, and they said it's, here's a quote, "The vendor's proprietary virtual switch module that is integrated into multiple Cisco products was much more consistent and reliable than DPDK-based open source open vSwitch." So they're saying that OVS's performance wasn't consistent and linear, but Cisco's VPP was. I'd have to see the whole evidence, you know. I don't know.
Right.
Let's come back to it next week.
Yeah, this is something we'll definitely keep an eye on and come back to.
Well, we might. We just say that so we can wrap it up and move on, really.
That's right. It's an easy transition. That's what we go with. Keep it simple. So, Greg, you had some finance news. One, Dell may be hitting a snag to raise enough money to finance its whole EMC buyout.
Yes, so part of my belief is that the networking industry is fundamentally driven by finance. It's not always obvious that IT is financially driven. It's not the only thing that drives it, but so I always like to keep an eye out. This week, the market fell quite substantially as part of the global slowdown, and this is having several impacts. One is, of course, that Dell is now struggling to raise the funding to finance the EMC Dell deal. They were supposed to raise $10 billion in loans this week, and that fundraising has been delayed because as the market slows down, Dell and EMC and VMware, all of the assets in that deal have dropped by 10 to 20%. It's not a good time to be raising for funding against the valuation of your companies, so delaying the deal seems all good while you cross your fingers and hope that the market picks up in a few weeks when you try to have another go at it.
All right, and some other finance news. Cisco announced its quarterly financials.
Cisco announced a very good set of results in that they basically came in on the numbers. Some parts of it are down. In particular, enterprise IT sales are down 4%, and that really hurt Cisco. But obviously, the losses from last quarter in collaboration, so that is around video conferencing and IP telephony, somebody's gotten out the cattle prod and gone and poked all the salespeople, and suddenly it's up 4%. So obviously, beating up on customers and beating up on salespeople gets results. So if you're a customer out there, expect your Cisco sales rep to be wearing out shoe leather and annoying you by contacting you endlessly and asking for purchase orders is clearly the message I saw. What Cisco has done, of course, it looks a lot like, and I've seen a few articles going saying that there was an awful lot of fairly clever accounting. What Cisco's done not to actually drop value here is that they've added $15 billion to buying back shares. They've increased their dividend substantially, so now they're one of the few stocks paying a 5% dividend yield, while their revenue and profits are flat, and they're predicting flat revenue and profits in the next quarter. Everybody else across the stock market is down 10 to 20% in the last 2 weeks. Everyone who's announced, like even today, A10 and Palo Alto have dropped 10 to 15%, even though they've come up with quite good results, but then they're not pulling some cash out of their back pocket to say, we'll pick up another $15 billion worth of shares, tot up the dividend by another 4 cents, and then all of a sudden everybody goes, you know what? That's a damn good dividend yield. Let's get into some Cisco shares. So Cisco's up 10% so far, and it's not exactly hitting it out of the park, but the fact that it's not going down is actually regarded as a win. So well done, Cisco.
Well done. Well, that brings us to the end of another network break. I want to thank our sponsors, Thousand Eyes and the Aruba Atmosphere Conference, and you can find more details about them in the show notes that accompany this podcast at packetpushers.net. Greg, if folks want to hear more from you, where can they get it?
They can find me on my blog at etheriumonline.com. Of course, many more shows on the fine podcasts on the Packet Pushers Network. And on the Twitters and social media is etheriumonline, LinkedIn, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mike, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Where can folks find more about you?
It's always a pleasure being on the show. Twitter is best, mfratto, and LinkedIn and others.
All right. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net, and you can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, please like us on Facebook or leave a recommendation on iTunes or share a link with your colleagues. And you can check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine, and Link Propagation, which you can find at packetpushers.net. And thanks for listening.